This is Eleanor Swend interviewing James Boyd at the Bancroft Library in Berkeley on September 4th, 1987.
It's a duplicate.
All right, this is continuing the James Boyd interview, and we're filling in a few things here about his graduate years at Colorado School of Mines.
It may be, it always reminded me that my father, although raised in Sydney, Australia, had a great friend who went to the Colorado School of Mines. His father said, no, you're going to go to the Royal School of Mines. And
that was your grandfather.
My grandfather. And so Dad was taken back when my grandfather transferred his office from Sydney to London, as a and going to the London Stock Exchange. And so he became an associate of the Royal School of Mines in London. When he came to California, he was not granted admissions to the university club because he didn't hold a degree. He's only a certain associate. However, they overcame that one. Then when I got to Colorado School of Mines, I was initiated into the ATO fraternity because I had been working with many Colorado School of Mines graduates from the radio company, and they saw to it that I was admitted to the ATO fraternity, and then became the worthy master of the second year.
What did the students call you?
They called me anything from Jim, Buck, Doc, when I got my doctor's degree, as long as they didn't call me late for breakfast, it was all good. They all had damn names for me.
Buck Boyd, so it was
The Buck Boyd came because I got tired of them rattling off on the mineral, not carrying on their work in the mineralogy class, and so I gave them a real stiff quiz. And when I came into the fraternity house for lunch, somebody in the back of the room said, "Buck Boyd rides again." Jack Benny was that time was talking about Jack Benny rides again, and so that's where I got the name from. That whole generation of students call me back. Still do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Then the lady who I lived with next door to the fraternity house, where we built a new fraternity house, and then I became the worthy master, was a great friend of Dr. Harry C. Brown, and she taught school in the Randall School in Denver with the doctor's daughter, and she brought her out, and I saw this very lovely lady with a great big hat on at the dinner party, and that's where I fell in love with her. She drove a Cadillac, and I'd had to come back in the streetcar when I took her home into Denver. About 3 weeks later, I took her to a ball of the Camp Lewis. That's not right. I can't remember the name of the military camp south of Denver where I used to get practice keep my commission up to date. And I saw the attention she was getting from other men around there, and I took her outside and said, "You know, I'm going to marry you." I scared her to death. But I think she finally fell in love with me because we were married a year later. Mm-hmm. So that's how I came to know Ruth. Mm-hmm. And she was teaching school in her aunt's school, and continued to teach after we married, because that teaching school there permitted her to go and carry on her social affairs as well as teaching affairs.
And she liked to ride.
She had had been born in the saddle. They had horses up in the mountains. They had a house at Evergreen. And all the time she was in school, they would go to Estes Park for the summer, and she would ride up in the... And I hadn't been much of a horseback rider. I had ridden as a child. But we went on one of these trips one day with on horseback, and I got a horse with a very stiff legs. And I was pretty tired before I got halfway home, and she took the horse over, and she thought she'd lost me. That's the only time I ever saw her in tears. So, but from there on, we were close. I would go into Denver on the streetcar. I didn't have a car then until I got a job with the Geological Survey doing some mapping in the summertime, and I had to have a car, so I bought the second car. I had bought a car when I was in school, in college. That's in there, I think. Mm-hmm. So, is that what you need?
I think perhaps.
Yeah.
Adds a little. This would be in the summer of when you were working for the USGS?
No, no, it was later.
No, that was later. Okay.
When I put that in there?
Maybe it's, I don't see it there. Working for the...
On another occasion, Ruth was my only helper, my four-man crew. She would lift a heavy sledgehammer to drive iron stakes into the ground. Now we can do it.
Okay.
You can put the insert there.
Mm-hmm.
I had, this is on?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. I had received a contract from the Reclamation Bureau to study the groundwater table, water table, in the Belle Fourche Dam in North Dakota. South Dakota.
That I know.
Yeah. South Dakota.
But
and
you pronounce it right.
Belle Fourche, yeah.
That's the way they pronounce it.
So we... As I remember, it was an earth-filled dam, and the design of the dams had to provide that the water table was brought down below the toe of the dam, and we could determine how deep the water table was by making these electrical currents flow through it and reading them. And that was my first contract with the resistivity, which we use in mining research later on.
Hmm. Oh, that's interesting. Right, now we're talking about 1949?
We're talking about 1948.
When was Korea?
Well, Korea was still going on in 51, so it was 48 and 49 when I was the Defense Minerals Administrator. The Geological Survey and the Bureau of Mines were helping the organization which was responsible for granting help to prospectors in the field looking for minerals. Now, I'm not too sure about that area. I didn't have anything to do with them, and except that our people in the Geological Survey and the Bureau of Mines got together and helped run that thing.
But Magma was, and San Manuel, were you involved in permitting?
Well, I would have been involved in some way or another in it, but not responsible.
I see.
Unless they had to come during the Korean War for help of, which I've mentioned in here, of course, is providing, proving certificates of necessity on rapid amortization.
Mm-hmm.
RFC loans and so forth. But the RFC did study their own loans. I didn't have to do that.
And of course, at that time, you weren't getting involved at all with environmental problems.
No. Well, you always got
not to the extent they do now.
No, not now. Mm-hmm. No, that came later on when I was. While I was director of the Bureau of Mines, I was constantly reminding the mining industry they were faced with environmental questions. I used to make speeches about it all the time. And some of them I got to pay attention to. I mean, they were making passes at it when they didn't really realize this was going to be a serious matter. And it wasn't until I set up a unit in White Pine after I had left Kennecott, that some people began, particularly Amex, began to take environmental things seriously, and they had a department. The man I had on my environmental work and set up in White Pine went to Amex later and is now vice president of Amex, and has had a great deal to do with the good that Amex has done, in environmental matters.
What's his name?
Better turn off for a minute. I'll have to think. See his face. My retrieval system gets slower.
I know. Well,
he's a great friend of my third son. They live in Evergreen.
Uh-huh. Well, we can probably look that up.
Yeah.
But he started with you at White Pine.
So I started him in that kind of business. He had his degree, and he's my quality control officer. Uh-huh. And then I turned over the environmental studies, and we had a very close working with the state commissions, and they. When we had any doubts about anything, we would sort of work with them from the very beginning. We wouldn't try to fight them. Mm-hmm. And he was very good at that. And the result was that they used to complain our smeller the smoke would do it. And so we even would close the smeller down when the wind condition was such that it was putting fumes down into the forest. Mm. But whenever we saw any leaves around, we brought them in to see whether it was caused by the smeller or not.
That is dead leaves.
Yeah, that's the damaged leaves. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. But there are other things that could damage leaves besides sulfur smoke. Uh-huh.
So it was mostly air pollution that you were concerned with.
Well, there, no, we had water pollution. Because after all, we're on the lake shores of one of the purest lakes in the world, Lake Superior. And we were doing some work to find out how we could more cheaply separate the gold and the silver, copper and silver. And we tried cyanidization, and we were worried about getting in, so we had to be sure to get the cyanide out before any danger of it going into the water. We never did set that up, but we were prepared to do that.
We didn't
use cyanide. We experimented with it, but we never actually put in a circuit, cyanidization circuit. That was under Tony Godin, Anton Godin at MIT. Mm-hmm. He was our consultant on that one. Mm-hmm. I think it was...
Mm-hmm. He and McQuiston were racing to develop some things together, as I understand.
Were they? They probably would have done. Oh. Yeah. But he was a consultant while I was at White Pine, too, when I was with Copper Rain. Mm-hmm. But I met him first in Michigan. When I in Nevada. And he was doing some consulting work up in there, and we did some geophysical work on his, some of his consulting places. So I had known him before I went to Copper Range. And he was been a consultant to Copper Range. And I expect he was the one that introduced my name to the election in the National Academy of Engineering. Which is, I was one of the, I was in the third election, I think, in the Academy of Engineering. I think Tony's the one who did that.
It's interesting that the Michigan mines always maintained that Boston, Harvard, MIT connection.
Yeah, that's right. Well, of course, they were the officers in Boston. And
well, they were discovered, I guess, by people. Well, no, the Indians discovered them.
It goes back to
Agassiz.
Agassiz. Mm-hmm. Agassiz was a Bostonian, I think, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And he really was one that discovered the copper mines or deposits in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where Copper Range came from. They had mines up in there. And White Pine came from that association.
And of course, that was totally different from the Southwest kind of copper, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, didn't the porphyry copper. These were vein deposits of native copper, mm-hmm. primarily in the Precambrian rocks.
Mm-hmm.
So there was chemical relocation of the copper there. We used to have sheets of copper in there. Sometimes hard to mine. How do you blast sheets of copper?
Mm.
The big trouble with mining in that area was when you got to these pieces of copper, they were high grade, but they were hard to get out.
Uh-huh.
You couldn't just break up the rock by blasting with dynamite.
Yeah.
You had to cut it with torches and things.
Mm.
Although we had little native copper in White Pine, but the mine that we were running, the old mines from Copper Range, were up in Painesdale, further north.
Mm-hmm.
And we operated one of those mines for a while when I was president. The man who ran that for us was later on ran Magma down in Arizona for Newmont.
Mm-hmm. Magma was developed with a lot of government.
That's right. That came out of that period where we were subsidizing prospecting for new resources during the Korean War.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure Magma came out of that. I don't remember much about it.
San Manuel.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I think so too, but I didn't have much to do with this, I don't remember. I just have to remember that it came along about that time.
Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's been a lot of changes in the government.
Well, copper, of course, White Pine, that was done with government money, set up, and I've described that in here somewhere.
So it's no longer a question just of finding the ore, it's also political.
Political, well, yeah, that was beginning, yeah, that's right. But we don't have any laws now that provide federal money for prospecting. And you haven't got an RFC to go to borrow money to put Copper Range into the White Pine operation. See, in White Pine, we had to get a certificate of necessity for the rapid amortization, number one. Then we had to get funds. They didn't have enough funds. They got $75 million from RFC, Reconstruction Finance Corporation. And I renegotiated it with the banks after the RSC Reconstruction. That's right, RSC.
Okay.
They got out of business They wanted to get out of business. Now, this is, we've covered that here somewhere. Yeah. Because I remember, you see, when I got out of business, get off the RFC, I made a loan from the New York Life Company. And that led me